Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. And I'm delighted to have back for the eighth time today James Lee Burke, and we will be discussing Feast Day of Fools, Mr. Burke's new novel, recently published by Simon & Schuster. And Jim, first of all, thanks so much for appearing on the show again.
Well, thanks for having me on the show again, Casey. I appreciate it.
Jim, I've got to say, with Feast Day of Fools, I thought that with Pegasus Descending and Tin Roof Blowdown that you had written a couple books which, with your background in New Orleans, and I thought those were your two classic books. But I must tell you, I think Feast Day of Fools, I think, is the best novel you've written.
It is. There's no question about it. And thanks for saying that. I appreciate it.
And I think what I like about it, Jim, and I'm not subject to hyperbole, is that it seems that there was a confluence of things that came together, just even when you look at the cover art of the book. And I had to do my research on some of the sections of this book to get some of the references you made. And if you would, tell the readers a little bit about the Feast Day of Fools that was celebrated back in the 1200s, what that was.
Yeah, the title of the book comes from what was a unofficial feast day in the medieval Catholic Church, and it was actually a folk ritual, but it was one that existed for about 900 years. And on this particular day, actually it was two or three days in sequence, all the lower echelons of the church, bell ringers, people who sweep out the vestibule, the guys, the real grunts who do the work on the ground, these guys were allowed to do whatever they wanted. And it was awful. I mean, they were out there, you know, getting drunk, fornicating, fist fighting inside the church, just whatever they had on their mind, they did it. And for a family show, I won't describe everything.
Yes.
After two or three days, they'd all come in drunk and hungover and receive collective absolution. And they had gotten it out of their system, and mm-hmm. then they went back to work.
Mm-hmm.
There's an FBI agent in the book who says we don't have that kind of Freudian release mechanism built into our culture today. We end up with a psychopath on our hands, like Preacher Jack Collins, who's a really bad guy.
Yeah, he's really something. But I want to kind of just go through a few of the things, Jim, that really stuck out on me. On page 58, you wrote, "But as John Steinbeck had said a long time ago, we had come to fear a man with a hole in his shoe."
Yeah.
About the campesinos, and I love the way you set this on the border in Arizona. And it has like almost like a biblical feel to it, where you set it and the issues that you're dealing with in Feast Day of Fools.
Well, yeah, the story is set down there on the border, and Hackberry Holland, who's the central character, is the sheriff there, and we've met him before in some of my short stories and in two previous novels. But in this case, he's dealing with narco gangsters who are killing very large numbers of people on the southern rim of the United States. The story is really about neocolonialism. And Dave Robichaux, another character I've written about, once said, "Wars of enormous consequence are waged in places that nobody cares about." And that's how I use the southwestern Texas desert, this great empty bowl down here on the border, where all these people, most of whom are morally insane, are killing one another. It's a highly allegorical book. It's my attempt at the passion play.
And you describe the southwest U.S. as being sawed loose from the edges of Canaan and glued onto the southwestern rim of the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
And when I read that, I just thought, wow, that's, you know, that's it's hard to argue against that.
It is the Great American Desert. It is a huge body of land. It's almost as large as the Mideast, that runs from West Texas plumb to California.
And Jim, in Feast Day of Fools, Pam Tibbs takes kind of front and center, and I was thinking there's almost a parallelism between Cleet and Pam in this book. It's a very complex relationship that she has with Hack, much as Cleet's is with Dave. But Pam, I mean, I think I'm in love with the woman.
Yeah, she's a great character, I think. Yes, she is. And Hack Berry, of course, even though in many ways he's still young, as an older man feels he'll be taking advantage of this younger woman's affections. And he believes that she's actually looking for a father figure, but at the same time, he's strongly attracted to her, and she's in love with him. So they're caught in one of those situations that our societal ethics frown upon. But in reality, I subscribe to the belief that there's always someone there for someone. We sometimes define ourselves in ways by age or sexual inclination or preference, and that have nothing to do with the humanity of the individual. We get distracted by issues that are cosmetic.
Mm-hmm. And if you would, Jim, tell us a little bit about Miss Anton and Lady Magdalena. She serves as kind of a moral voice in the novel as well.
Yeah, she's the spiritual figure in the novel. She's a Eurasian woman who had worked for Air America, which of course was a CIA front. And Air America, of course, had an earlier incarnation in the form of Civil Air Transport, which was a airline founded by Claire Chennault. My wife flew with them 2 years. That's right. My wife went through two wars. But this lady is a very spiritual person, and she's doing penance for some of the things she feels that she should not have done in Cambodia, or rather, Laos. And she feels responsible for some of the suffering that took place there. But that part of our history is often lost on us, in part because it's not reported. But neocolonialism has been unfortunately, our legacy, or the legacy we inherited after World War II. We've walked in the footprints of the French and the British, and those footprints are in the sand, and I think we'll come to the same end as they did, but we haven't realized that yet. It'll take time, but it's going to be a bloody slog, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. The preacher and Hack have a very complex relationship, to put it mildly. And one of the things I really enjoyed about Feast Day of Fools is the preacher has a respect for Hack. And in fact, he insists that his underlings call him Mr. By Mr. or by Sheriff. And there's an understanding that the preacher has, and Hack is not going to rest until Hack understands a part of himself in the preacher that he does not like, but he does understand.
Yeah, Hack Berry even relates to him sometimes. He realizes that both he and Jack Collins are anachronisms. And Jack Collins, who dresses in rags, he dresses in clothes that, you know, yellow with soap. He has a terrible body odor. He's unshaved. His face looks like it was stung by bumblebees. But in his peculiar way, he's a gentleman. And he also feels that somehow he has walked out of the pages of the Bible. And this is what makes him so frightening. In my novel, Rain Gods, and in the sequel, Feast Day of Fools, Jack Collins is emblematic of those who have hijacked Christianity for a nefarious enterprise. And I think it's a phenomenon we've seen in our country in recent years, and there are men in our midst who have used religion to further an agenda that's truly pernicious.
And the character of Temple Dowling kind of represents kind of that hijacking, doesn't he? Or he kind of serves as a kind of a voice for you to kind of look at it. There was one line that said, one had the sense that the club was a place where no one died, where all the rewards promised by a benevolent capitalistic deity were handed out in this world rather than the next. And I about fell out of my chair when I read that.
Well, Temple Dowling is exactly the guy you described. Yeah, he's a defense contractor with ties to intelligence agencies. He's a wicked man. He hires others to do his dirty work. He's one of those who finds men who are amoral in nature, gives them a vague suggestion about the bloody agenda that's at hand, and then never wants to know about it. And Dave Robichaux talks about this. He says, Hackberry Holland does. Hackberry says, every professional soldier, every executioner who works for the state knows that part of his job is to protect his employer or the people whom he serves from knowledge about what he has been hired to do. And that's the kind of man Temple Dowling is. He's a fellow that belongs to a country club where all political correctness ends at the front gate. I used to be a newspaper man. I met some of these fellows.
Yes. Yeah.
I'll take Jack Collins anytime.
And, you know, Jim, as I read this book, I thought to myself, this book is a book I think that will be read in 50 years, 100 years. And there are really only a couple authors that I put into that category. And another one that another author I think will be read 100 years from now is Jim Harrison. And you mentioned him on page 175. And you said, I met Jim Harrison. You didn't say it, but Hack said, I met Jim Harrison once. He's a novelist. He said, we love the earth, but we don't get to stay.
Yeah. That's right. I heard Jim Harrison say that. So Hack mentions that for me.
And that also kind of is a kind of a theme that runs throughout through the novel. And it seems to me that Hack is confronting his mortality. In this book, Jim, which there on page 200, I won't read the entire passage, but you talk about that that death was only bad when you had to face it, knowing you'd failed to live during the time you were given it. You know, and that you had just turned your back on a lot of things. And I thought that paragraph was symbolized Hack, and he's getting tired of all of this.
Yeah, I think all of us reach a time in our lives when, number one, mortality is not an elective study. And the greatest theft in our lives becomes the theft of time. And remorse, which I think is probably the worst emotion, this side of despair, that a person can experience, results not from what we did in our lives, but what we did not do. And I heard a priest, he was a redemptorist who had been a chaplain in Thailand, say that. He said that he had sat by the bedside of many a dying person, that he said they regret what they didn't do with their lives. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the sense of loss. I mean, time is an irrevocable loss. You know, and each tick of the wristwatch is a subtraction from our time on Earth. I think it's why older people get so irritated with those who waste their time. They'd rather have their money stolen or anything except wasting of one's time. That's what you learn. I think it's the only wisdom that I've ever seen, in my life at least, presented to me by age.
You even mentioned in that paragraph that as Hack is thinking about this, that we have this conception that as people age, that they become happier, and that, you know, all things improve with age. And Hack makes some very insightful comments there that, you know, says, you know, that that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, and that's probably the best way to put it. It's not necessarily true. It may be true for some people. It's not for Hack, and it's not for me. Hackberry's never figured out any of the great mysteries, as he says. And that's what we always believe will eventually happen. We'll discover why the innocent suffer. We'll have demonstrable proof of divinity in our lives. We'll see an explanation somehow for all the events that have taken place in our lives. We'll understand causality. But I don't think, at least in my case, that's true. That doesn't mean I feel less about my life. But I think maybe the only thing that comes to us with age is ultimately a tolerance for error and imperfection in others. And again, an understanding that all we have is today. Yesterday's a decaying memory, and tomorrow doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But we also come to realize something else, that death has always been with us. We just didn't see him standing next to us. He
mm-hmm.
was always there.
Mm-hmm. And one character we haven't mentioned, Jim, is Joseph Shalikov. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't be doing justice if we didn't talk about him and his role in Feast Day of Fools.
Yeah, Joseph Shalikov, we met him earlier in Rain Gods, is a truly iniquitous human being. He's a worse man, actually, than Jack Collins. He's a gangster, of course, a guy that got into the country during the collapse of the Soviet Union, was given, you know, immigration status here. He became a porn merchant.
Yes.
That's how he pays back the favor.
Yeah.
And he's a horrible individual. I mean, he looks not only goat-footed, as the satyr is, the Satan, but he actually looks like a goat. And he's a, you know, sybaritic man. He's degenerate. He's cruel. He's also involved in the drug trade, and he's an arms dealer. And he operates out of Phoenix. But his real issue is with God. He's at war with God. And Jack Collins understands that, and so does Hackberry. And all of these figures come together in search of what an FBI agent and Hackberry refer to as the Holy Grail. But the Holy Grail in modern times is the secret of aerial weaponry. In this case, it's a guy, he's a Quaker who worked for the Defense Department and wants to give the design for the Predator drone to Al-Qaeda. Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I had to cover up my mouthpiece for a second.
Okay.
Yeah, and he is. There's one scene, Jim, with Cody Daniels, which we won't tell the readers. But it's one of the most horrifying scenes I've read in fiction. But when you talk about the allegory of the Passion Play, my stepfather's actually from Oberammergau, and it was in the Passion Play a couple times in a scene at five or six times.
Uh huh.
And that scene is, that's when I started saying, you know, this Feast Day of Fools, this is the world we're living in today.
Well, that's what the book really is. It's an allegory that makes use of the story of Jesus and his followers, but it's contemporary. And we meet this fellow, Cody Daniels. He's a mail order preacher.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also, as we discover, a man who was involved in the bombing of an abortion clinic, and he disfigured and blinded for life a nurse inside that clinic. And he's haunted by what he's done. But as we see, that he evolves into a rather noble figure.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene describing his denouement, of course, is horrifying, but he seems to rise above it.
Mm-hmm.
The ordeal that's imposed upon him. But it's the search for redemption. That's what the book is about. And mm-hmm. we meet Krill, who is
yes.
the narco gangster from El Salvador, who is obsessed with the death of his three children who were killed by a U.S. Army helicopter. He's declared war against the United States, but we discover again an unlikely hero in this man who's driven by hatred.
And Jim, one of the things I found myself laughing out loud at times, not at these characters, but Preacher Collins is a linguist.
Yeah.
And I love the scenes where he corrects the guys on their use of metaphors and similes, and I found myself just laughing out loud at how irritated he got at the misuse of the language.
Yeah, he's self-educated. He spent his life in public libraries. He never spent one day in jail, but he's obsessed with correct grammar, and he's, of course, he's surrounded by men who are psychopaths, and they all fear him. They know his potential for violence. And he owns this Thompson 45 caliber machine gun. He uses these big 50-round drum magazines, and he's a really dangerous guy.
Yeah.
And they're afraid of their syntax and their spelling. And also, they're afraid to use profanity or racist language in front of him because it sends him into a rage.
Yes, yes.
Or if they say something that is misogynistic about women, they're going to have to deal with Preacher Jack.
That's right.
My favorite scene in the whole book is when this dirt biker out in the desert, who's vandalizing the entirety of the environment. He's scouring big tracks in the sides of the hills and riding through the flora, blowing up cactus, and he runs into Preacher Jack Collins and has no idea what he's dealing with.
Preacher Jack makes Clint Eastwood look like a pacifist.
Preacher Jack is heck on wheels, brother.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, that was one of my favorite scenes, too. Because at that point, Jack Collins doesn't care, and Hack doesn't care, and it's really, really primal. And on page 462, you write, "But if a man tries to put all the lessons he has learned on a road map for others, he might as well dip his pen in invisible ink." And I thought that was a brilliant line.
Well, thanks. That's the biggest joke of all about age. Anything you learn, you cannot pass on. Once in a while, maybe, but it's very rare.
And for those of us that have read all of your work, Jim, there are some treats in there. Like, you make reference to the first book in the Hack Holland series towards the end, which I really, really loved. And the ending, I was thinking to myself as I'm reading this, the book is so good. Again, we're discussing Feast Day of Fools by James Lee Burke, published by Simon & Schuster. The book is so good that I did not want it to end. And the the ending, Jim, how long did it take you to come up with the ending with the mermaid? I mean, it's just so perfect the way you end this novel that I was kind of walking around because I didn't want the novel to be over, and I thought, how is Jim going to finish this? How is he going to wrap up this novel? So when you got there, just how did this come to you?
That's a good question, because I didn't know how it would end either. Mm-hmm. And the night before I ended the novel, it came to me at 11 p.m., and I keep a notebook by my bed, and I wrote it out in longhand, and then I wrote it on my computer the next morning. But I never know how any book of mine is going to end, but this one was the one that was a real mystery. I never saw it coming. I never saw that ending until the night before I wrote it.
Okay. And I remember, I'm sure you don't remember this, but it was probably 25 years ago in Columbus, Ohio, at a Barnes & Noble on Sawmill Road, and I didn't know you then, and someone asked you about your process of writing, and you said something about each morning you prayed that the muse would appear, and that you didn't like to think about it too much more deeply than that, because you were afraid one day it might not show up.
Well, I still feel that way, and I believe the story is written by another hand, actually.
Okay.
I believe it's written in the unconscious, and it's given to certain people,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily because they deserve it or there's anything meritorious about them. It's everyone who's ever taught an art class or a creative writing class or a drama class knows this to be true. Background, genetics, socioeconomic status, culture, they have nothing at all to do with talent. It's like some guy's walking down the street and he gets hit by lightning. And did you ever see the film Amadeus?
I did.
Yeah, Mozart.
Yes.
Mozart was the clown, the jester. Mm-hmm. This is why he was despised by Salieri.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because God had given this incredible talent to an idiot. Salieri out here struggling in the vineyard all day, and all he gets for his work, you know, is criticism and denigration. You know, one time Salieri had written this sonata. He was so proud of it. And he gave the sheet music to Mozart at a party, and this is in Vienna. And, you know, it's filled with very, you know, rich and noble people from the royalty. And Salieri said, Amadeus, I wanted you to perform this, to play this for me, and I would be so flattered. And Amadeus said, oh, I'd be happy to. And he took off his shoes and played Salieri's music with his toes on the piano while everybody laughed.
Wow.
On another occasion, Salieri never wised up. He was supposed to give a performance in front of the King of Austria, and he didn't have time to make an extra copy of his sheet music, so he asked Amadeus to do it for him. So Amadeus scored all the music using six different colored pencils.
Oh my.
So it's like trying to read, you know, read digital camouflage.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
And so Gary started playing, and he made a mess of it. Was booed off the stage.
Oh, that's great. That is great. Well, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right, because the reason a couple times where I've had to put my finger over the microphone is because I'm teaching creative writing now in Orlando, Florida.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I've been doing it for 3 years now, and this is my fourth year, and you're absolutely right. I see brilliance in students that they don't see themselves, and it doesn't have, I believe it is a gift. And,
well, it is.
It is a gift. Now, you have to have the drive, because Chuck and I were talking, Chuck Adkins, the editor, and I were talking beforehand about it. You know, there's a note at the end of the novel here that you submitted your first novel 111 times, and it was rejected. And then when it was finally accepted, it was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. And Chuck said, "Why don't you have me ask him about that?" And I almost started laughing. I was going to say, "Well," I said, "I don't know if he'll want to answer that question or not."
Well, yeah, that was the Lost Get Back Boogie.
I said, but that shows a persistence that, I said, he must have believed in that novel enough to have sent it out 111 times, and it wasn't important to him. It was just important to, I said, but I'm sure he had moved on to another novel by then.
Yeah, I went through a 13-year period in the middle of my career when I couldn't sell anything, and I amassed hundreds of rejection slips, and the Lost Get Back Boogie has set a record. It's well known in New York. It's the most rejected book in the history of New York publishing.
Wow.
And now it's published all over the world. And it's, you know, actually, I think a very good book, but...
It is a great book.
But I have no explanation. I cut 80 pages and then submitted it to LSU Press, and they published it. But they resurrected my career. See, I'd been all those years writing novels and stories, and I published in 13 years' time one original paperback, which was Two for Texas, you know, story of the Texas Revolution. But anyway, I think I had to, in answer to your question, I had to relearn an old lesson. You do it every day, a day at a time. You write for the pleasure of creating the work. Mm-hmm. When you finish it, you put it in the mail. When it's rejected, you give yourself 36 hours to get it back in the mail again. I've had that rule for myself since I was 20 years old.
Beautiful.
It stays under submission. You never let it stay home. And you go on and you write the next poem or play or outline for a screenplay, whatever it is. But you never stop. And if you do, you'll be unhappy at everything else you do in your life.
That's fascinating.
You can't. If you set it aside, you'll feel that remorse we were talking about earlier. And plus, it's all rock and roll. The only thing that's important is to just be inside the music.
Yes.
You know, remember what Danny and the Juniors used to sing? Rock and roll is here to stay. We don't care what people say. Rock and roll is here to stay. What a lie.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I also thought of your cousin Andre Dubuis when I read that. Andre used to just put stuff in the mail and get right back to the next story, and didn't, and he, you know, and I think of him often, you know, and his son, you know, Townies was such a great book.
Isn't that a great book?
Just a great book.
It's the best autobiography of a writer I've ever read.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's an outstanding book.
Yeah, I interviewed him about that, and we had a great discussion about it.
I think that Andre, little Andre, we still call him little Andre.
Yeah.
Young Andre, he felt maybe that, you know, he was saying too much, but he didn't. It was honest, I think, and I think his dad, if he could speak to us, would say that, and his dad would be happy with that book. And
I would agree completely.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Let's finish that thought.
Reconciliation, ultimately. He's able to forgive and to accept his dad. And, and his, you know, his dad, you know, was very tragic. You know, he was lost his legs, you know, in an accident when he stopped to help some people on the highway. And the last 12 and a half years of his life were in a wheelchair. He never got out of the wheelchair. There was no prosthesis.
Yeah, he was something. Jim, I want to, before, as we wrap up here, I just want to tell you that I'm going to write a major review of this of Feast Day of Fools. I think it's an important American novel. I think it's probably one of the best American novels I've read in the last 20 to 25 years. I think it's an important book for people to read, and I'm not saying that because you and I have become friends. I really think it's that good. But I want to give you a chance just to tell readers about a book you wrote called White Doves at Morning, because I think that's kind of fallen off the radar. I think people go through the Robichaux list, they go through the Hack Holland, they go through your books, and I think maybe that one has fallen through the cracks. And I know it's one of your favorites, so if you would, in the last couple minutes here, why don't you tell us about White Doves at Morning and why you like that book so much?
Well, that book, which is a historical one about the run-up to the Civil War and the Battle of Shiloh, and then later events during Reconstruction. That's among the three or four of my best novels, but it never received much attention, and it contains also my best female characters. The illegitimate black woman, she's half white, she's the daughter of the man who founded Angola Prison. He was also a Confederate colonel who was at Shiloh. But I used real people. I used my ancestors, and I also used Nathan Forrest, you know, the legendary cavalry general in from Mississippi. But it's also analogous to our times. And, you know, the South did not secede as one entity. Secession took place over a long period of time. Only after the newspaper syndicates and the cotton interests convinced large numbers of people that a civil war was in their interest, and of course it was not, but racial and sexual hysteria was the key to proselytizing people who really had no vested interest in the war. That's right. James McPherson's book on the Civil War, the Pulitzer Prize book he wrote, deals with that, how media influenced people to do things that proved to be a calamity.
Well, good. Anyway, I appreciate it. I wanted to give you a chance just to mention that, because I think that that's a book that your readers that have read everything, they can go out and get White Doves at Morning and see a different side of your work and thoroughly enjoy it. So, Jim, I just want to, from the bottom of my heart, I want to congratulate you for Feast Day of Fools. I mean, this is a beauty. Well, Jim, I'll tell you, it's great getting caught up to you. When I read this, I mean, I'm not kidding. I read a lot of books, and I just said, this is an opus. Your picture should be up on the wall at Barnes & Noble with this book and the body of work you've gotten. There's a short list of people whose work is going to be read in 50 years, and I think it's you and Harrison and a few others, but not a lot. So,
well, I sure appreciate it.
Yeah.
Casey, it's really been a great interview.